I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more to my liking. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Read my lips.
Just send your cash.
There has never been so many lies, so much deception.
Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Please clap.
It's time for the Mike Madison Show, a new breed of conservative talk. Now, here's your host, Mike Madison.
Showtime! Woo!
All right, good morning. Welcome to the Mike Madison Show here at 103.9 WYAB. I am your host, Mike Madison, here weekdays 9 to 11 o'clock, offering up a safe space to the independent thinkers out there. If you are one of those people, have some level of intellectual curiosity, the next hour will be very interesting. We've got Brett Montague. He is the CEO with End It For Good. If you are interested in alternatives to the current drug war, this organization is out there making the case. They're crisscrossing the state of Mississippi and doing some international appearances. I've had Christina Dent, who founded this group, on. And this is looking at the drug war and the problems that we have related to drugs in our society from a conservative Christian perspective, but challenging the idea that what we're doing for the past 50 years is accomplishing anything except making things worse. So we'll talk to Brett Montague next hour. I really do like this organization. They come at it from a great position. As I say, Christina Dent is just, she's quite amazing. We'll probably talk a little bit about Christina's story, how she came to her opinions. This is somebody who I don't believe has ever had a drink or a drug in her life. I know she's never had any drugs. She doesn't drink either. This is not somebody fighting for her right to use substances, but just looking at the carnage that has been left in the wake of the drug war and thinking that we can do things from a better perspective, particularly if we profess to care about other people. This is a topic. It's a big topic on this show. We've been doing something so stupid for 50 years now, and the evidence is in. The definition of insanity. Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, we 50 years. I think we're good on our current approach. So anyway, Brett Montague, CEO with End It For Good, will be on next hour. As I told you, this is a show for independent thinkers, not for everybody. Quotes of the day today before we get into a bunch of stuff. I've got some very interesting. I was doing research last night at about 12:30 in the morning. Or I guess that would technically be today at 12:30 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. And so I did what I do, which is not a great habit, turned on a podcast and was listening to an American Scandal podcast that's talking about one of the guys that's been doing reporting on congressional scandals when it comes to trading stocks. And there's some pretty interesting stuff in this thing. I'll tell you about the title of it and everything when we get to it, but I'll play a couple of clips. I really can't wait to get to that. This did not help me fall asleep because as I heard what's been going on in the halls of Congress when it comes to the scam that is insider trading that we know Congress does, it really kind of got me fired up. Probably cost me another 30 minutes of sleep as I got jazzed and started making notes as to what time parts of this show I needed to segment for today's show. So anyway, interesting stuff. Quotes of the day today. George Orwell said, "It's not so much staying alive, it's staying human that's important. What counts is that we don't betray each other." George Orwell. Never saw social media. Never saw Twitter. This was an interesting one. This is William Blum. I believe I've done this before, this quote from him before. He is a former U.S. State Department employee. But it's been a while since I read it, and I ran across it again. This is William Blum, a former U.S. State Department employee. The State Department really being that organization that runs the empire, that sends our kids off to wars. So this is William Blum, former U.S. State Department employee, said, "No matter how paranoid or conspiracy-minded you are, what the government is doing is worse than you imagine." No matter how paranoid or conspiracy-minded you are, what the government is doing is worse than you imagine. That is from William Blum, former U.S. State Department employee. I got to tell you, my imagination runs wild with the evil, psychopathic things that our government does. If it's worse than I even think what they're doing, we're in big, big, big trouble. This was a great meme. It's out there. It's talking about licensing. I should save this, and we'll come back to this quote again on Thursday, next time we have Americans for Prosperity. I'll try to remember to save this, but it says licensing. When government takes away your right to do something and sells it back to you. That's quite the scam. Yeah, that'll be up the alley of Americans for Prosperity. And then I've got an audio quote clip of the day today. There was a big move made in the Libertarian Party. Now, I am a small L libertarian mainly. I want to be left alone. Our government is too big. It meddles too much in our lives. And the politicians that you'll hear highlighted in a little while when we get to this congressional trading scandal, they have too much power over our lives. I want to be left alone. They have too much power, period. They have access to too much money, period. And so I've been a small L libertarian now for about 17, 18 years. But I have not been a big L libertarian, meaning I've not been an adherent to the Libertarian Party, because it's really been run by a bunch of nut jobs and some left-leaning libertarians as well, which is strange. There were some people in the Libertarian Party that were fine with the masking, even with some of the lockdowns. They thought it was all for our own good. It was a very bizarre thing to see, but I'm not a party guy anyway. I'm just an independent guy that wants to be left alone. But over the course of the weekend, they had the Libertarian Party convention, and some much, much more sane people have taken over the Libertarian Party. And it's going to be very interesting to see if they can make a dent. I'm under no illusions they're going to win the presidency in 2024 or turn Congress anytime soon, but they will be a sane alternative to the two corrupt political parties that we have. And essentially the people that have taken over the Libertarian Party now are the Ron Paulians. This is the Ron Paul Liberty Movement 2.0 is really what they're calling it. These are people who believe we need to end these endless wars, end the Federal Reserve, end the income tax, end the war on drugs, end the federal involvement in our lives across the board. And they come from the Ron Paul school. So if you've been a Ron Paul fan, or if you've admired anything that Ron Paul has ever stood for, the Libertarian Party may actually be a party you can be a part of now. I'll be very interested to see. Now they are charged with trying to make a little bit of noise. We know the two big major political parties aren't going to let them into any debates or anything. They'll never get a national stage unless they somehow wrestle control away from the Republicans and Democrats that have a monopoly on power in this country. But it's very interesting to see, and I got to tell you, it's kind of exciting to see the Ron Paul movement. Ron Paul was actually, Ron Paul was a Republican congressman from Texas, but he is a libertarian guy and really the father of the liberty movement of the 2000s. He was at the convention. Even as a Republican, he was at the convention kind of giving his stamp of approval to these people. But Dave Smith is a libertarian comedian. The rumor is that he may end up being the candidate for president on the Libertarian Party ticket. Now, am I under any illusion that Dave Smith could win the presidency? No, I'm really not. He's a young guy. I think he's late 30s. Smart as they come. He's an incredibly smart guy. Very articulate, very common sense guy. I think he's a great spokesperson for libertarianism. But I think a lot of people, like I say, really the Republicans should be the good ground to sow for the Libertarian Party. But so many Republicans really want freedom, but with a lot of asterisks around it. They still believe we need to be the world's policeman because they've been so hoodwinked to believe that China is about to come over here in a couple of ships and take all our stuff. That is a bit of a tough sell, but he will be interesting. Dave Smith has been on the Joe Rogan program several times. You can go check him out on an old Rogan podcast and get a real feel for what he's about. But because he's a young guy and he understands social media and he understands the culture war, they have taken the wokeness out of the Libertarian Party, where unfortunately it was residing. And it'll be interesting to see the waves that they can make. and particularly with young people, I think is much more fertile ground. The boomers, many people in my generation, X, are just not ready for real freedom. They talk about it, but they're not really ready for it. But the young people is where the battle for hearts and minds will go on with the Libertarian Party now. It'll be interesting to see. But this was something Dave Smith was just talking about, the corruption of our government and how it interferes with the progress that we actually could make, particularly when it comes to economics.
United States of America, between the end of, let's say, take the end of the Civil War to about 1910, so about 1865 to 1910. In this, and I'm not saying everything was perfect back then, I'm not saying it was a libertarian society, but economically speaking, looking at it, there was no central bank, there was no income tax, there was essentially no federal regulation of the economy. The national spending was something like 2% of the national income. By today's standards, you'd be like, this is basically anarchist. There's literally no government intervention. And in this time period, we had the largest at the time expansion of wealth, the biggest improvement in the lot and life of the average man in the history of the world. There's the wealth that had never been thought of before was created. Now, the problem that I think freedom has is that also a Milton Friedman quote, he goes, you know, freedom is in the general interest, but it's not in anybody's special interest.
There's the issue.
And so what happens is as the wealth gets created more and more, the government tends to siphon off it. The parasitical class tends to siphon more and more and more, and this grows the government. And so this is the issue that we've been dealing with. It's like because we're the richest country in the world, it was because we were the most free country in the world, we become the richest country in the world. Because we're the richest country in the world, we now have the largest tax base. This leads to the government getting bigger and bigger, and now we have the largest government in the world, the largest, most powerful government in the history of humanity. It's the United States federal government. So that is the challenge. But it's not as if no country has embraced the entire libertarian program. That's also true for Marxism. It's not as if any country really embraced every single word he ever wrote. But the countries who have embraced more freedom have been the most successful countries in the world. I think my view for what the solution is to that is to create as much of a libertarian populist uprising as we can have.
Amen. Amen, brother. People do not understand that freedom creates prosperity. People have been hoodwinked to believe that a political party or a politician is what creates prosperity. That's absolutely not true. It's absolute freedom. It's true freedom of people. It's already been done here. That's really the frustrating thing to people like me. I have these conversations with people from time to time. I say, yeah, we kind of have tried libertarianism. It was called the founding of the United States. There's been a whole lot of times in American history. It's just that since the early 1900s, the corporatists took over with things like the Federal Reserve, started taxing people. Everybody thinks taxes have always been around. They have not. We actually tried this. It was very successful. And then we let a political class come in and hijack it. And we still, up to and including today, are doing that right now. Be right back.
Radio is the sound of salvation. Radio is queen of the nation. They say you better listen to the wise side of reason, but they don't give you any choice because they think that it's treason.
Stock market had a big rebound at the end of last week. It was attributed in large part, I believe, to short covering, meaning people that were betting against the market had to actually, they locked in their gains and they had to buy shares of stock. I won't explain short selling right now, but you should look at, understand it as it's a part of our economy and part of the stock market. Market was looking a little weak today, but I think we're on the cusp of, as interest rates rise, of seeing a reduction in debt across the country, which is going to be, I'm going to show you in just a second or try to explain to you, the illusion of prosperity that Americans have been sold. And it's a shame. It really goes back to Dave Smith saying, you know, before we had income taxes and all this regulation, we created real prosperity for people. They moved from really abject poverty into middle class, into some level of security here. And then the oligarchs got in control, set up a central bank, instituted a tax system, and started the debt markets here in the United States. And I'm going to show you how hooked on that we are. But I ran across one story that's really, really sick and sad. It's about crypto. I ran across this story on Yahoo News. It said they lost major coin and now the tax bill is due. I want you to just listen to this and think about the sad state of affairs of a country that terrorizes its citizens in this way. Riding high off a record year of growth, many cryptocurrency investors filed a tax return on mind-boggling gains this spring, some in the range of 20 to 30 times their original outlay. But now it's time to settle up with the IRS, and there's a problem. The money isn't there anymore. The crypto market endured its worst crash in years this month, wiping out more than $400 billion in value in a matter of weeks. Message boards were flooded with comments from people saying they'd lost their entire life savings, and others who would worry they could lose their homes. Tax attorneys who specialize in crypto told the Daily Beast that they too were inundated with calls from people who had lost more than they owe in taxes. Quote, "This is the biggest issue in crypto right now." That's from Clinton Donnelly, the founder of Crypto Tax Audit. Quote, "We have several clients who have just gotten wiped out and they're just terrified." Donnelly recalled one client who made $700,000 last year trading between cryptocurrencies, but didn't think to convert any of that money to cash to save for tax season. When Donnelly's company told him what he likely owed, he was horrified. Much of that $700,000 had evaporated in the crash. Clients like this, Donnelly said, quote, are in a panic. They don't really know how to go forward preparing the tax return. It's a serious ethical quandary. And this story goes on about all these people who last year they made record profits in these cryptocurrencies. And of course, the federal government has stuck their snout in there and said that you can't earn a buck without paying your VIG to Uncle Sam. Well, now they've lost it all. Now, in a fair system, maybe they would just be able to say, hey, all those gains I had last time, they're wiped out now. But no, see, they have to pay this money now and then wait until April or January of next year to file a return to claim the losses. In the meantime, they'll be ruined for 7 or 8 months. Now, they'll be able to carry over these losses and write them off against future gains for a while, but this won't make them whole for probably decades. And they are terrified. They're terrified of their own government because the government is coming for all of those gains, taxes on all of those gains. Gains they don't have. Gains they never realized. They never sold these things. They didn't ever pocketed the cash. They just had these paper gains. And I guess the government is coming for their piece of that. But it's just sick. I hope it should be a lesson. You know, cryptocurrencies are known to be fairly libertarian because they're decentralized. It's the thing that I'm most drawn to about cryptocurrencies. But I hope it also clues people in other libertarian concepts, which is abolishing the IRS, abolishing the Federal Reserve, abolishing the income tax, and not replacing it with some stupid fair tax or flat tax. To me, that's like the sheep trying to decide which brand of razor they want to be sheared with. We did just fine as a country with no individual income tax for 150 years. We'd be fine without it again. As a matter of fact, it would unlock some prosperity. The reverse of that, however, is true in the United States right now. And I don't even remember how I got to this, but we've seen numbers of the savings rate just went through the roof when the government was sending out STEMI checks. Everybody was banking this money. There wasn't a whole lot of places to spend it necessarily, except for Amazon. I guess they left the Walmarts open while they shut down Main Street, but a lot of people had a lot of cash sloshing around on all of these STEMI checks that were coming out. Well, that's long gone, and we've seen the transition from savings to credit card debt. I've reported on this a couple of times over the past couple of months as the increases have been incredible. On months they might anticipate $18 billion more in credit card debt for American consumers, the number comes in at $54 billion. And this is also because of the inflation that's been created. People are trying to keep up their standard of living in the face of rising prices. I did a little bit of research this weekend to look at credit card debt because it has crossed some kind of major thresholds here. It's more than savings now. Credit card debt right now in the United States is $841 billion. That's actually a $15 billion drop from the $856 billion in the fourth quarter of 2021. But it's the charts that are pretty amazing. Now, I want to bring this up, too, because I talk about the illusion of prosperity. And this is an interesting statistic because we were told that Donald Trump's America was the most prosperous, the greatest economy of all of mankind throughout all of history on every planet in the universe. It's interesting that the record of credit card debt for Americans was $927 billion, and that was in the fourth quarter of 2019. Now, why did we need all this credit card debt if prosperity and cash was just sloshing around the economy and everybody was doing great? Now, there is a way of thinking that says people load up on credit card debt when they're optimistic because they just feel like they can start buying a bunch of stuff and they'll be able to pay it off down the road because things are going so great. Now, that works until it doesn't. And 2019 was one of those times where we were heading into 2020 and that credit card debt came ashore during 2020 when they had shut down the economy. But looking at these charts, there's a very interesting one of revolving consumer credit since 1968. 1968 is when this chart starts, and it's in the billions of dollars. In 1968, that number is around zero, maybe a few hundred million dollars in outstanding consumer credit in the United States across. And remember what the middle class was doing in the 1960s. They were buying homes. They were setting up the suburbs. They were taking vacations. You had one parent working, and yet they didn't rely on credit cards, strangely enough. This number starts to increase, strangely enough, around 1971. What happened in 1970? Oh, that's right. That's when they took us off the gold standard here in the United States and made money printing the new way to fund everything. There's a nice little tick up in about 1977, but still only to a few hundred million dollars. In 1977, this is as inflation. Same thing happened to people back in the 1970s. There's a lot of parallels between now and the 1970s. You know, we look at some of these cities that are racked with crime right now. I don't know if you've gone back and looked at anything from the 1970s. You go back and find documentaries about the 1970s. New York City was circling the drain in 1970s. A lot of these big metropolitan areas, the crime was through the roof. I'm sure this was also inflation related as well, as people struggled to keep up. We had stagflation in this country. The cities were really decaying, and they came back. That should give us some level of hope that maybe this is just another stage very similar to the 70s with the inflation and the decay and the crime and the violence and just the aberrant behavior of people. Go back and look at the 1970s. It was not a fun time during the late 1970s. But this chart goes on in revolving credit card debt. The 1980s see a nice little uptick. And then the 1990s, you remember how go-go the 1990s were? When the internet stocks were taking off, Bill Clinton was in office, everything was just seemed to be really be going swimmingly. But the increase in credit card debt is darn near a straight up line during the 1990s. And by the year 2000, we had gone from a few hundred million dollars in credit card debt in 1968 up to $600 billion by the year 2000. Then we had the Bush years and the prosperity of the housing market. You remember when the housing was just flying up? Strangely enough, increasing housing values didn't have any apparent effect on credit cards, as credit cards shot through the roof during the 2000s too, culminating in about 2008 at around $1 trillion. And this is what I'm talking about, that there is this illusion of prosperity in the United States that they have sold us. In 1968, things were going pretty well in the country, save the Vietnam War. Civil rights movement was largely settled. We were making our way out of that segregation era. But a lot of people were moving firmly into the middle class during the 1950s and 1960s without borrowing a nickel. But if you look at these charts, and now we are still up somewhere close to $1 trillion. It's, what did we say? About $850 billion in credit card debt, and that's heading into an environment where interest rates are going to rise. This is a recipe for disaster. But when you look at this and just realize this is this stealth inflation tax that's been going on since 1971 in particular, that people have been maintaining their status, maintaining their standard of living by putting it on a credit card and calling it prosperity. Now, it's going to be interesting to see if we have a true financial unwind here, or a lot of this debt is wiped out, exactly where we end up back. Do we come back to some level of solvency where there's a strong middle class that's not so reliant on debt? Because you can't be if you got to pay 15% to borrow money for a car or to borrow money for a house. We're going to see if maybe we actually, it's going to be ugly. It's going to be painful, but maybe we get back to something more similar to when the middle class in this country was created instead of the last 40 years where the middle class has been decimated. These credit card charts are quite insane to look at. It really shows you this country has sold us a bill of goods. It is debt. This is a debt-based country, not an economic progress thing. It's not has anything to do with anybody, one particular person's experience. There's a lot of successful people out there that are socking money away, and they've got a lot of investments and no revolving debt. But as a society, this shining city on the hill is built on a mountain of debt. I'll be right back. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. Thanks for joining me today. I love documentaries. I've learned a lot over the years from documentaries. I'm a pretty avid reader, but I like good quality documentaries, and I like good audio shows as well. And there's a couple of podcasts that are out there by a company called Wondery that are very interesting historically. I particularly like kind of scandal stories. There's a podcast out there called American Scandal, and it does all kinds of different things. It'll be, the WeWork Ponzi scheme, Enron, Theranos, the steroid scandal of Major League Baseball, these kinds of things. And they're little 45-minute segments of these stories. But I was listening to one about, I've been watching Billions, which I'm coming to understand is really seems to be completely based on the federal government going after insider trading charges against SAC. Stephen Cohen was a hedge fund manager that was apparently trading on inside information, and the federal government went after him and just about everybody that works with him. Now, there's a libertarian argument to be made that insider trading should not even be illegal, because if you made it legal, there would actually be services out there for us little people that would alert us to mergers going on or anything else. There would be people out there digging up information to spread it out everywhere. You're never going to stop insider trading. And the government is very, very selective on who they go after on some of these insider trading charges. You know, a lot of the people who work for places like the SEC or people in financial crimes, they tend to find themselves working for some of the big financial firms, and it's in pretty bad form to go in there and bust up people that you might be asking for a job. You know, if you're working as a, air quotes here in the studio, civil servant for $89,000 a year in New York City, and you know if you're with the SEC making that money, and if you play ball and turn the other way and maybe get some favorable treatment to some of the big banks or private equity groups that you could be making $600,000 working for them, we can understand why there is selective prosecution of these cases. But this particular podcast was the FBI versus SAC, this hedge fund and their insider trading. But what was even more interesting than that story, and I think it's a four-part series of how they would bust different traders at this hedge fund trying to get up to Stephen Cohen, the head guy, was the final episode of it, which dealt with Congress and their insider trading problems. And I've got a few clips of that I wanted to play for you. This is the guy that is talking is Dave Leventhal. He's Insider's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief, and they started doing some reports. He said it's his beat to go out there and look at the Congress critters and their conflicts of interest in their trading. And I think there's some very interesting clips in here that probably most of us don't know about.
Legal. It was done in practice. And ultimately, Congress could not stomach it anymore and decided to pass this bill.
Now, what he's talking about is back in, I believe, 2012, There were so many scandals erupting. We saw people, a lot of people talk about it. Nancy Pelosi, whose husband just got a DUI, apparently. How are you worth $100 million but won't come off of $26 for an Uber? That just is shows a lack of respect for anybody else on the road. But, of course, they are American royalty. But we know the stories of Nancy Pelosi now suddenly being worth $100 million. Benny Thompson here in Mississippi. A little boy from the Delta made good, went to Washington, D.C., and is now worth tens of millions of dollars. So Congress kind of went and did something about it. Apparently the optics were just getting so bad for all these Congress critters getting rich that they passed a law about trading and set up some guidelines for trading in Congress. That's what this guy's talking about.
What it was also supposed to do is create a new and enhanced transparency regime where members of Congress who were still allowed to, for example, buy and sell stocks. So if a senator wanted to buy 100 shares of stock in ExxonMobil, if a House member wanted to go and invest in General Motors or General Electric or General Mills, they could do so still, but they would have to disclose the fact that they had purchased or sold that stock within, at least by congressional standards, a relatively short period of time. And that time period was 30 to 45 days based on the kind of trade that they were making.
Now, I find even that interesting. We certainly have the technology where if a Congress critter places a trade, they could make that public that day. It could just be a rule for them. When you trade, you let everybody know what you're trading on that day. Now, if you're trading on inside information, 30 or 45 days is an eternity. Because generally, you're trading on something that is going to transpire within days, if not hours. You get a heads up that something's about to happen. Something's going to be announced in the next couple of days. So you get your position in there. You get the announcement. You get the run-up or the knockdown in that stock. That's what insider trading is about. So conveniently, they made it 30 or 45 days. But apparently, they won't even live up to that.
So that all sounded all well and good when Barack Obama put his John Hancock to the bill and signed it into the law, and off we went. But what we found in the here and now today, Lindsay, is that the reality of the Stock Act has not lived up to the expectation of the Stock Act in many very, very important regards, and that members of Congress, as well as top congressional staffers who are also subject to this law, in many cases have just simply ignored it. And that the penalties for violating it are inconsistently applied when they're applied at all, and that the penalties are very low to begin with. So in essence, we have found dozens of examples among lawmakers and nearly 200 examples among top congressional staffers of people who have violated the Stock Act since 2020.
There were, I recall, some high-profile trades and reporting.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a break right now. I'm going to come back. So they found all these instances of these people that have violated their own law. Their own law that they put over themselves on this trading, this insider trading at the congressional level. Well, so when we come back, we're going to find out, well, what happened to those people? Certainly they were held to account, right? Wait till you hear the results of the prosecutions for insider trading at the congressional level. I'll be right back. All right, so we're gonna look a little bit deeper at this. I ran across this. This is from American Scandal, and again, this is Dan Leventhal. He is with the with Insider. He's their deputy Washington bureau chief, and they did some investigations into insider trading at Congress. And they, Congress years ago set up this little rule. Hey, it was basically a public relations package. Hey, we pinky swear we're not going to do this stuff again. Look at all these rules we've put in place so that Congress doesn't go in and abuse their authority, abuse their privilege, really, to inside information about, because Congress weighs in. This is part of having such a powerful and meddling federal government. They're in everything. So they are constantly passing laws that benefit or harm an industry or a particular company. And Congress knows this, what will pass, what will not pass, what announcements are coming out of the Fed or out of the Treasury or economic news. They know these things long before we do. And it's been long established they've been trading on these things. And many of the people that go to Congress is basically, probably mostly upper middle class to moderately wealthy, end up being fabulously wealthy after they've been there. So they set up these rules to try to tell us that they're going to monitor their own. Here's more from this account from Dave Leventhal.
Members of Congress following the rules of the Stock Act.
One of the most notable features of the Stock Act, some might consider it to be a bug, is that the penalties are incredibly low. For example, we'll pick on Representative Pat Fallon. He's a Republican from Texas. We found that he made dozens upon dozens of stock trades that together were valued at upwards of $20 million potentially, and that he violated the Stock Act by disclosing all of those trades weeks or months past a federally mandated deadline for doing so. And this deadline is in place so that the public can have transparency into lawmakers' finances to determine for themselves whether a lawmaker is basically trading stock on congressional knowledge or making stock trades at a time when a particular company might be lobbying Congress to a very strong degree or have a bill that's pending in Congress that, could dramatically affect them and their financial fortunes. So Pat Fallon, he made these trades. They were all late. They added up to a huge dollar amount. What was the fine that Pat Fallon had to pay for this transgression? Well, it was $200, because that's the fine for any transgression when it comes to the Stock Act, at least as far as Congress is concerned.
And that was, just so you remember, it was $20 million worth of stock trades. He was found to have violated this law that they set up to police themselves on $20 million of stock trading. He paid a fine of $200. And I would imagine most people have never even heard his name, never even knew that this took place.
So in essence, that's one situation that, has been replicated many, many, many times over the past couple of years, where there is very little incentive, at least from a penalty standpoint, for members to do the right thing. And that's been one of the criticisms of the Stock Act in particular, especially from those in Congress who would like to change the Stock Act, or definitely good government group types who feel that the Stock Act is decidedly weak. They say that the penalties are a joke, that they should be a heck of a lot stronger, and unless there are real consequences for members violating the Stock Act, the members will continue to do so.
And of course they will. And there's one further thing. So there have been essentially, I mean, the fines are incredibly small. So how many people have actually been even fined on this stuff? How many people have been prosecuted or found guilty of these things?
Almost impossible, as it is right now, to prove that a member of Congress has engaged in insider trading as it's defined in the Stock Act. And why is it so difficult? Well, it's difficult because the burden of proof is incredibly high on the government. So Congress itself is the first line of defense when it comes to enforcing the Stock Act. So if somebody has done something wrong, either the House or the Senate Ethics Committee can look into it, they can investigate it, and, theoretically they can penalize a member to a relatively strong degree if ultimately somebody has been determined, a member of Congress, to have violated that insider trading provision of the Stock Act. So how many times in the past 10 years has a member of Congress been basically found guilty within the House Ethics or the Senate Ethics Committee of violating insider trader provisions of the Stock Act? Well, the answer is zero. It has never happened. And how many times has the Department of Justice gone after a member of Congress and prosecuted them for insider trading, even after investigations? Well, the number there is also zero. So in practice, in reality, you can see that, number one, there may be certain disincentives to going after one of your own, and that is the nature of politics, that's human nature. And also, too, that when it comes to any type of criminal violation, that there either has just not been enough proof or there has not been the stomach and the appetite for the Department of Justice to go after a member of Congress in this regard. And part of that is just baked into the Stock Act, that because the burden of proof is so high, because you have to have such a level of evidence to prove that somebody has engaged in insider trading, and you have to get basically beyond the countervailing arguments that members of Congress can say, such as, oh, well, I'm just using public information that's available, or I'm very good at stock trading. The closest thing that we've gotten to insider trading with a member of Congress in the past 10 years is with Chris Collins, a former member of Congress from the Western New York area, who was ultimately convicted on insider trading related type activity, but this did not fall under the Stock Act. It was actually prosecuted under a completely different law, separate and apart from the Stock Act. And although Chris Collins did serve a brief period of time in federal prison for this, he was pardoned by then President Donald Trump.
So one guy caught for insider trading, it wasn't with Congress, it was outside of that, and Trump pardoned him. We are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. I start off every show by explaining to everybody this is a safe space for independent thinkers out there. And I believe there are a lot of things that we are kind of trapped in old modes of thinking. There's been a lot of stuff sold to us, whether it's, you know, I do a lot on domestic politics. I do things on foreign wars. You know, I'm an anti-war guy, unapologetically anti-war. And I think a lot of people are kind of coming to these conclusions, but it's time for different thinking on a whole host of topics. And I believe none more urgent or more important than the way that we approach this war on drugs. I've talked about it a lot here on this show, and it's because it's harming this country. You know, I'm not going to spend this hour, because I have a guest with me, explaining all the consequences that I see from the war on drugs, or we may get into some of it, but We've been fighting a 50-year war on drugs, pretty hardcore. It really goes back even further than that, into the early 1900s. But really since the 1970s, when Richard Nixon declared this war on drugs, and Reagan kicked it even higher into gear, and we've been off to the races ever since, spending over $1 trillion. And the result has been we've got more drugs of higher potency that are actually cheaper than they were before. We can't keep drugs out of a prison, yet we believe we can keep them completely out of our society. And it is time to start thinking differently. This is where the independent thinking actually comes into play. So today I wanted to do a show. One of my favorite organizations out there that talks better than I do about this particular topic is an organization called End It for Good, and it's headed by Christina Dent, who has been on this show before. And I wanted to bring in somebody from their organization, talk a little bit about drug war or better approaches to fighting the war on drugs. And today we've got Brett Montague with us. He is the CEO of End It for Good. So, Brett, thanks so much for joining us today.
Mike, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I know Christina thinks very highly of you. She talks about you all the time. I feel like I know you without even having met you.
Well,
we've not met in before this morning, but it's a pleasure and honor to meet you, and excited to be here with you and your audience.
Well, thank you. Christina's just fantastic. I have been producing / occasionally co-hosting her podcast, which everybody needs to get if you're at all interested in this topic. You know, it's a weird thing in Mississippi. Usually it takes somebody's personal experience with addiction somewhere in their life to really explore the topic. But Christina's got a podcast out there. She's interviewed a lot of great people, and I've been able to produce these podcasts for her. It's called End It for Good, and it's available on podcast platforms. So I've enjoyed doing those things with her. Christina and I are probably very different people, but I could not be more of an admirer of what she's done. She comes at fighting the drug war from a compassionate Christian conservative perspective, which is what would sell it here in Mississippi, which is just taking a look at this and exploring some different ways. Christina's also not judgmental on anybody who believes that, you know, drugs are evil in our society and we need to do, you know, lock up every person who gets within 10 feet of them. I mean, you know, she is happy to meet anybody where they are, but I think it's long past time. As I say, we're 50 years into a hardcore war on drugs, and all of the results show it is a failure and has made things worse across the board. I mean, we've got rising death rates from, you know, all kinds of different things. Drugs are cheaper. Fentanyl has made it almost a death sentence for somebody who tries drugs for the first time because of the law of prohibition, which means they try to smuggle the most potent thing in the smallest pack to avoid authorities. I mean, it's just up and down. We probably won't unpack the entire thing today. But you're the CEO of End It For Good. How in the world did you find yourself being involved in an organization in Mississippi that's trying to change people's minds on the approach to the war on drugs?
Well, Mike, it was quite a journey. Not all of it was happy either. But it, you know, it's very, very interesting. I'm a native Mississippian. You know, come from a family a line of well respected attorneys on my dad's side, and on my mom's side, well respected educators. You know, grew up in a very loving, thriving environment, nurturing environment. Taught with the right values. And, you know, growing up, I also, you know, in school, you know, the DARE programs, Douglas,
right.
Just say no. If you would have told me even 10 years ago that I would be doing what I'm doing today, I would have told you that you're crazy and I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I can sell
right.
you. But here I am. It's been a, as I said, not always a happy journey, but it's been very organic. It's been very profound. So the gist of it is, as I said, you know, came from the right family setting, family environment. I have one sibling, an older brother, Douglas, who's 2.5 years older than me, way smarter, way more charismatic, way more charming, way more capable. But my brother, when we were coming of age, fell into a trap of an addiction.
Yeah.
Between somewhere between, you know, his junior senior year in college, fell into it. We both coming up experimented with a number of substances. I did too, but I got really involved in my studies, my work, and I could go into all of that. I got really fascinated by what I was studying and where my life was taking me, I just kind of put, you know, any drug use party into the side.
As most people do.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting somebody who during the course of high school or college or early adulthood didn't try this or try that. I mean, that's not an abnormal thing. It's just that most of us are very lucky that we just, you know, it didn't evolve into some level of addiction. Same thing with alcohol. I certainly was a huge drinker in college, and it's not like I'm proud of that. It sounds like I was a huge drinker in college. But, you know, as I moved on professionally, as things lined up the other way, I didn't have time for that. I was getting on with my life. So most people have experienced or experimented or have somebody that they love, a spouse, a child, a brother, a sister, that have all experimented in these things.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Well, you know, and we can talk about the pros and cons of decriminalization or legalization or whatever, but just think about it in terms of this. Any Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock, you and I can go to a liquor store and we can buy enough tequila or bourbon or whatever it is to kill ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
But we're not going to do that. You
right.
and I aren't going to do that. Why not? Why don't I go to a liquor store at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday morning? It's not because I don't have access.
Right.
It's because I have meaning in my life. I have other things going on. I have a purpose. I have responsibility. I have a mission. And so I want to be present for those things. And that's really the ultimate, what I saw as the ultimate driver of Douglas, my brother, falling into his addiction. It was, so after I got out of college, I did 2 years in the Peace Corps, did 2 years service in the health sector of the Peace Corps in Paraguay, South America. It was a life-changing experience. And it was in my second year down there in 2007 when I got a call from my dad telling me that my brother had entered his first stint in treatment after, you know, falling into a heroin addiction. And just sitting there, like, on the other side of the equator, feeling kind of helpless. You know, what can you do? You're on the other side of the equator. I started thinking about it, reflecting on it, and it hit me that his career in life had never really taken off.
Yeah.
And here I am, you know, beyond our shores, making a difference in the world, impacting real lives, traveling, and he's just a sitting duck who's stagnated, right? So he started turning to other things. We went through about a 10-year journey after that with him. He cycled in and out of rehab 7-8 times. We put him in elite treatment centers. We put him in bare bone treatment centers. We left him incarcerated once for 3 months. There were family interventions. We tried everything in the book,
it's
right?
It's got to just be heartbreaking and just to go through that.
It was horrendous.
Yeah.
There was one specific family intervention that was really traumatic, and it resulted in my grandmother just, you know, she was just shedding tears, and my dad was... He just had to be stone cold hard, and you know, and it was tough. It was very, very hard to witness and be a part of. But we felt like it was necessary at the time. We were following the script that traditional society tells you to, which is, you know, you have to save your family member from themselves.
Right.
The reality is, though, is that we cannot save human beings from themselves. You know, we can show love, we can show compassion, we can be there to advise, you know, yada yada yada, listen, but we can't save people from themselves. And ultimately, you know, I believe the war on drugs was partly waged under that pretext that we had to save human beings from themselves.
Right.
These substances are bad, and we have to save people from themselves.
Right.
But it's a false choice. And how I came around to understanding this, if you'll give me a few minute of latitude, fast forwarding from 2007, you know, when my brother had entered treatment for the first time, to 2017, on February 25th, 2017, my brother's 38th birthday, after that whole journey, you know, all the interventions, incarceration, et cetera, my brother overdosed on his 38th birthday, and he was very lucky. He was resuscitated with Narcan. A friend was close by, had it, you know, did not run.
Yeah,
you know, resuscitated him. But it was a rock bottom moment for him because he had, you know, how the cycle goes, and it's like a tumbleweed. He lost his job,
yeah.
Then lost his house, then lost his car, and he's out on the streets with backpack and his dog. And, you know, and 2 days later, he overdoses. And so this is kind of a watershed moment for my family. And, you know, my family throws their hands up in there, doesn't know what to do, but he's my only brother. So I went to where he was outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, and I learned from a friend of his that he had been put up in a Motel 6. And it was one of those Motel 6s that you and I would not be caught dead in. But Douglas was in there. So I went in there, and I realized real quick, just after about a half a day, that like, oh, like, he's just so depressed, despondent here, watching stupid TV shows with no sense of direction.
Yeah.
There's nothing that I can do that's going to change his situation. If he's going to get better, it has to come from him. So I decided to change my tack and just not impose on him in any way or push. And I just sat back and listened. And it was interesting because over a four-day period of just, you know, using that as my MO, He came around to making his own decision and said, I want to rebuild my life and I need a job, but I need to get into treatment first to make that happen.
Yeah.
And I want to get into treatment. Will you help me? And I said, Douglas, is this what you want? Because if this is what you want, I'll do whatever you want and I'll help you right now. But are you just telling me what I want to hear? And he said, no, this is my time.
Yeah.
And I was like, great. And from that experience, I walked away from it, and I'm driving home, and I'm like, whoa, wait. So we spent a decade trying to intervene, impose, criminalize everything, you know, just using these punitive measures to get him better. And then over here, I decided to just back off and listen and those things. And so I asked myself, you know, do more compassionate, humane, restorative-based approaches to drugs work more often than punitive criminal ones that we've been using for 100 years.
Right.
And you know, you brought up that the war on drugs has, you know, been going on for 50 years. It's really been going on longer than that. If you go back to, you know, after 1914, the Harrison Act was passed. And,
right.
Harry Anslinger.
Harry Anslinger.
He was, once alcohol prohibition was repealed, he kind of had to justify the perpetual existence of his bureau.
Right.
So he turned up other substances as well. And he was really the first person to use the term war on drugs.
And what people need to understand too, you know, I talk a lot on this show against individual income tax, not that they're related in this context, but people don't have a context to understand. And why do I have to constantly remind people? We didn't always have that. We didn't always have this war on drugs. I mean, back in the turn of the century, around 1900, you could go to the equivalent of your neighborhood Walgreens and get heroin or get other drugs, get marijuana for ailments or for, and I'm sure some people used it to alter their consciousness. But we didn't have a, you know, we didn't have an entire police state set up around these things. I'm sure some people maybe abused it. I mean, the, human beings are flawed individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the 1900s, these things were not criminalized. They were not illegal, and we still built a thriving country. I mean, we were on the ascendancy with no drug laws in place right now, and now we've had them on the books for 100 years. I believe we've been fighting it hardcore for 50 years, and it just shows it doesn't work. We need to take a break, but I want to come back and kind of that cycle that your brother was in. You know, one of the things that I've learned largely through Christina too, and some books that she's recommended and resources, is the cycle of trauma and then drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a machine in our drug war right now that inflicts almost the maximum amount of trauma on people.
We do.
Which forces them within their mind to try to mask that trauma, to escape that trauma through more drug use. It is like this horrific circular program that we're embarked in right now. So we'll talk a little bit about that trauma and addiction. We want to find out how your brother's doing and how that ended. But it's you know, like I said to start this show, you came to this. Didn't think you'd be doing this 10 years ago for sure. I mean, you are, and this we're talking to Brett Montague, the CEO of End It for Good. You didn't think you'd be doing this, but so many people's lives have been touched by this that. That it's kind of bringing people around to maybe kind of explore if there's a better way to start dealing with this problem in society.
Yeah. Well, it's organically happened. I'll be glad to talk more about it. It's an honor too, and enjoy being here with you. Look forward to more conversation.
All right, we'll be right back talking to Brett Montague. I'm saying your last name correctly.
Montague.
I'm not saying Q, aren't I? Montague. he is the CEO of End It for Good. I definitely will give you resources to check out their information if you're interested in this topic. And as I say, a lot of people have been touched by addiction. A lot of people have encountered the war on drugs, either yourself or through somebody that you've loved. If you think that there's a better way to do it, these are some of the resources that you can take a look at. We'll be right back.
I went home with a waitress the way I always do. How was I to know she was with the Russians too?
All right, we are back with Brett Montague, the CEO for End It for Good. So you sat with your brother. You had this addiction in your family. You sat with your brother. You kind of saw over the course of 12 years, I'm sure you saw the involvement of law enforcement. I mean, I'm sure you pretty much over the course of 12 years when it comes to addiction, you saw it just about all of it. Yeah. So how did everything end up with your brother?
Thanks for asking. My brother is doing well today. He's in recovery. He's actually out in California. He's just gotten into a new home and is going to be starting work with the VA actually, and he won't necessarily be serving those who suffer from substance use, but you know, he's stable, sober, you know, working, living in stable housing,
yeah,
and many people who fall into that trap, number one, don't survive. Number two, don't get back to a place of recovery and stability. It's been a very, very long road for him. He did have one spiral during COVID as well.
COVID. A lot of people relapsed. Yeah. It's just shut down programs for people that were having addictive problems. I mean, oh, gosh, that's really sad. Yeah.
That was another big stumble and hurdle to overcome. But Douglas is very, very smart, very capable. I would love to think that what I'm doing, too, at In It For Good is inspiring him to get better, stay better, be better. I've gotten that from him. You know, he hasn't said that explicitly, but he's made it clear in so many words, and that makes me feel good about me, because he's the reason that I got into this. You know, it was personal for me. You know, we've impacted a lot of other lives too, and built some unlikely alliances, like with some law enforcement officials that you wouldn't. Like, when I got into this, I was like, oh, one other quick story that kind of sheds light on how I ultimately got here. About 11 months after my brother's overdose episode and that whole epiphany with him, I had a work-based experience that got me here. And it was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. My background is in HR, and I was an HR manager for a manufacturing facility outside of Hattiesburg, and a candidate walked through my door for interviews. Once a week, I had application interview day, and these candidates would come in. And this one guy comes through our door, and he has a very eerily similar demeanor and personality to my brother.
Once you've been around somebody who's been in the throes of addiction, you can recognize it pretty quickly.
You can. Yeah. You can. And this guy, he comes in, like, and just the way he carries himself, I'm like, this guy's a leader. And I took him on a tour through the facility, you know, engaged, asking questions. Very charming, very charismatic. Aced his interview, asked great questions, and it was best interview I've ever given. And this was just expecting to be, you know, an hourly day labor guy. This guy had a higher, you know, capacity than that.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make an offer. There was one hang up, though. This guy was very transparent on his application, and he disclosed that he had just gotten out of our state prison system after serving a 2.5-year sentence. Come to find out, 3 years earlier, at 23 years old, after 6 months of falling into an addiction, this guy was arrested on a nonviolent drug felony possession charge.
Yeah, yeah.
And nonviolent drug possession charge, which was a felony. So he did 2.5 years in prison.
Wow.
Didn't become a criminal in prison. Yes, was met with help, with handcuffs when he should have been met with help. He was suffering from an addiction.
He was 23 years old for a nonviolent thing for possession. He got 2.5 years
two and a half
in prison.
Years.
And this is a kid that's got all the promise in the world. He made some stupid mistakes. Good Lord, I'm still making, you know, I'm significantly older than 23, and I'm still making dumb mistakes. And he did something dumb in his 20s, and he's got this charisma and all this potential, and we decide to put him in a cage is the way to treat this. That's horrible.
Yeah. And he had a wife and a 4-year-old child. Anyway, you know, he didn't become a criminal in prison or anything, and he's, you know, trying to rebuild his life genuinely. And so, you know, when he disclosed that, I had to do what I had to do and go to my boss to get concurrence. I still wanted to make an offer, and I took it to my boss, made my pitch. And the response, unfortunately, that I got was, if we hire an addict with a felony record who just got out of prison, that's going to set a bad precedent for us.
Yeah.
We can't make an offer. And I just walked away from that conversation scratching my head, and I was like, I don't agree with that at all. No. Like, here this guy, you know, he instead of being met with help, he was met with handcuffs, went into prison, did not become a criminal while in the pen, got out and is genuinely trying to rebuild his life. He's paid his dues. And now we're basically telling him, no, we don't want you. We want you in the shadows.
Right.
So it happened.
You're a bad person. You've got the scarlet, you know, you've got the scarlet A, the scarlet addict on you now, and nobody wants to touch you. You're a throwaway person.
Yep. So it had me asking a number of questions to myself. One, you know, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to just perpetually punish? Or are we actually trying to restore life?
Yeah.
And two, this guy, now that he's essentially been barred from working in the legal economy, what will he resort to to provide for his wife and child? Will he start selling drugs, engage in some other criminal activity? You know what? And then thirdly, I was like, oh, I was just like, okay, we didn't see the person. We saw his past. And now he has limited opportunities. He's losing, and so are we.
Yeah.
Because we had a potential asset there. So I feel like our company gets hurt too. And that's really what was the straw, the last straw that broke the camel's back for me. And it got me along this journey. And there's a guy in Hattiesburg. His name is James Moore. He's a businessman down there. And he's an activist down there on this issue. And his son died of an overdose in 2015, which is why he got into this, you know, kind of as his personal atonement for not being able to rescue his son. But I went and met with James a couple of times, and afterwards, after, you know, the second or third time we met, he goes, "You need to meet somebody." And he did an email introduction between me and Christina.
Yeah.
That's how we met. And then he sends me a separate email, and he said, "Hey, this girl, Christina Dent, she founded this nonprofit, End It for Good. You need to look it up. Here's the hyperlink. And you need to watch this TED Talk she did." And I'm like, wait, this woman did a TED Talk? Who is this?
Yeah.
And I watched it, and I was like, yes, she's got it. Long story short, I contacted her. And at first, in November 2019, I coordinated a community discussion, a community-based event in Hattiesburg for her. That's where I'm from. That's where I live. And I invited 143 people out of my network that I thought it would be relevant for to come and join us. Out of those 143, 120 showed
Holy
up.
Holy cow, really?
Yeah.
And good for them.
And, I mean, it was like both our incoming and outgoing DA, our incoming and outgoing sheriff, our mayor, you know, soccer moms, a wide variety of quality people. And I was like, there's something to this. There's really appetite for this.
Well, that's
for
that's
this
really,
conversation.
Yeah, and that's great to hear some people in the system, because there are a lot of police officers out there right now that know that they are just, they're just locked in this cycle of ineffective way to treat people. They've seen the horrific stories. They've seen the,
they have.
You know, and when I come back, we need to take a break, but I want to come back and talk about the role of trauma and, mm-hmm. and addiction. Because and you do you remember who it was that said if you tried to create a system that encouraged more addiction, you couldn't. I mean, you would put out the American war on drugs. The war on drugs is the system. Do you know who that quote is?
Dr. Gabor Mate.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think he said, if I wanted to design a system to produce addiction on a mass scale,
yeah.
I would design the present war on drugs.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Essentially.
Yeah, so that, I think that's a good explanation for people and why this has been such a disaster. All right, we're talking to Brett Montague. He is with End It For Good as their CEO. We're going to stick around for the rest of this show, so stick around. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. This is the Mike Madison Show, 103.9 WYAB. We're talking to Brett Montague, from the CEO for End It For Good. I wanted to do this real quick. This is going to be a little bit of a shorter segment, I guess. Well, sure. I don't know. Whatever. One of the things that I don't think people understand, and I think this is always important to bring up, to me, it's one of the most impactful things. The role that trauma plays in addiction. And so it's this vicious cycle of trauma a lot of times in childhood, or it can be something that happens to you as you get older, you know, a divorce, the death of somebody that you're very, very close to sends you into trauma. Then people turn to drugs. They also turn to alcohol. They also turn to food. I mean, any of us that sit out here with some kind of a level of judgment on anybody who has an addiction should really take a look in the mirror. We're almost all addicted to something. But they may turn to drugs as an addictive thing to respond to that trauma. Then we throw in law enforcement. Suddenly these people are arrested. They're incarcerated, which is a trauma in itself. And like the guy you were just talking about, then they come out and they say, okay, well, I did my time. I'm going to rebuild my life now. Then they're turned away and it becomes hard for them to recreate their life because of the stigma of having done time in prison, which is a new trauma, which takes a lot of people, and they try to mask this new trauma using the same substance they had before. It is just this vicious cycle, and people don't think they really understand. There is a
I think there's a large majority of people who look at drug addicts as throwaway people. They're doing bad things. They know better. They just need to go out and get a job and be productive. But it is the unseen traumas that they've suffered that is largely responsible for addiction. And what you and I were talking about off air that I found fascinating was that I always thought if you took one hit of crack cocaine, you were a crackhead. If you took one dose of heroin, you were a heroin addict because these chemicals would get such a clutch into you. Now, I'm not encouraging anybody to go out and try this or test this because these things are not healthy substances. Nobody's encouraging any drug use. But the things that drive real addiction are the traumas that people have suffered, and it's why some people sink into addictions. Not all, but some people sink into addictions because of that they are trying to escape some inner pain that most of us can't see. And when you look at people who suffer from addiction from that context, that they must be suffering from something. We need to dig this out with them and really try to help them work. As opposed to they've done something illegal, now they need to pay their dues. Now they can't do the crime time, don't do the crime, that kind of thing. When you change your mentality on that, start to see these people as human beings who may be suffering from something we can't see, man, it changes kind of the approach to me anyway.
Well, and so one of my questions is you know, if you to the refrain of if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. My question is should addiction be a crime in the first place?
Amen. Amen.
And I don't think that's a very hard question to grapple with. We can talk about means to go about, you know, approaching drugs, whether you talk to, you know, legalization, harm reduction, whatever these menu of options may be, which are all just means to an end. We all want the same goal in the end. We want minimal levels of addiction. We want minimal levels of overdose death. We want decreased crime. We all want those things. But, you know, whatever policy prescriptions we're talking about are just means to get there. I also want to be crystal clear. It's super important for me to say to your audience that at End It For Good, we do not in any way, shape, or form trivialize, celebrate, or encourage drug use.
Of course not. Yeah.
Not at all. What we are saying is in our approach and what we advocate for is that we recognize that drug use is always going to be with us. You know, mankind has been fermenting crops and plants since pre-biblical times.
Right.
Drug use is not new. It's a mainstay in our society, and it's not going away. What we're saying is we want to manage, you know, these substances, like with alcohol and tobacco, in a way that minimizes harm done to human being. And the fact is that criminalizing drugs makes everything around drugs worse, from the supply side to the consumption side and everything in between. And there's not enough conversation about that. In terms of the trauma, there is growing conversation about it, but there's still not enough. We just believe that people use drugs because they're bad.
Right.
And like you said, if you use cocaine or crack or whatever it may be, that you use it once and you're addicted. And that is not true at all.
Right.
In fact, about 90% of all substance use, whether it's heroin or bourbon or you know, cocaine, 90% of it is classified as what's called non-problematic.
Right.
The other 10% of the problematic drug use comes from things like, partly your genetic makeup, partly your circumstances in life. If you're in a terrible place, environmentally or whatever it may be, but the biggest contributing factor is trauma.
Yeah.
And by incarcerating people because of that trauma, by piling more trauma on that initial trauma, we are deepening more addiction. And we are sowing the assurance for higher overdose death rates in the future. And we already have record-breaking overdose death rates in America.
Yeah. And you know, right now the big conversation is around fentanyl, which I believe would not even be a thing in some kind of a legal, regulated market in any way, shape, or form. Anheuser-Busch is not about killing their customers on a single dose. Jim Beam does a lot of quality control to make sure that they've got a product that can alter the mind, but it's a responsibly used product, you know, but there are still sad stories about it. I mean, we just, there's a lot of people, a lot of conservatives understand this idea of,
you can't give away your freedoms for, you know, this illusion of safety. Well, it's the same with the drug war. You know, the unfortunate things happen. You know, people are flawed and we make mistakes, and some of us do have to, you know, address some trauma. I wanted to talk real quick. I just got a couple of minutes, but I just think this is the Rat Park experiment. I wanted to talk about that a little bit. It made a huge impact on me, and this show and having you on is really about getting people to think about things in a different way. So what the Rat Park experiment was, and correct me if I'm wrong in any way, you're more the expert than me, but there were advertisements that showed that you know, they put a bottle of water with cocaine in it into a cage with a rat and said, look at this rat. He just keeps going back. There's two bottles of water. One's just regular water and one's with cocaine. But as soon as that rat tastes the cocaine water, that's all they want. And they keep going back to the cocaine water. They become immediately addicted to this cocaine water. And now look at that. They're dead. And this was really, you know, hyped up in the war on drugs. And so who was the guy that did the experiment? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was Dr. Bruce Alexander in Vancouver. And I can't remember if the substance was, you know, water-infused heroin or water-infused cocaine, whichever it was, though, you're right. They absolutely just put these rats in a cage, you know, with water by itself on this side and a water bottle, you know, and then the heroin or cocaine infused water on this side, and said, you know, which side will they go to? Well, 100% of the time, because they're just in this cage, they go to the drug.
Well, I think it was a single rat. It was just a rat.
No, it was a rat.
So
it was
a rat isolated from everybody else. And
that's
so
right.
What Bruce Alexander did was an experiment where he created a little rat heaven with toys and other rats to form bonds with and live kind of the ideal rat life. Mm-hmm. And then they put these same water bottles in there, one pure water and one with drugs. And these rats tasted both of them. And occasionally they might go over and use
very
the drug
sparingly.
Water. Very sparingly. But they just use the regular water because the rats were happy. They were not. And so what it was this one rat that they used to show everybody the harms of these drugs. And again, neither one of us are saying that drugs are good for you. But this idea that they were traumatizing that rat. They put him into a cage by himself with nothing to play with, no nothing. Basically put him into solitary confinement and then gave him drugs. And it was addressing the trauma of being separated from all those rat buddies with no rat, you know, comforts, no nothing, and just living in this box. I can't imagine many people who, if they were forced to live in a box by themselves, cut off from everybody else, wouldn't be trying to seek some level of escape as well. But when they gave the rats a fulfilling life and an environment that was fulfilling, the rats did not become addicts. And I think that is a huge experiment that really shows. And you mentioned one other thing, too, that you said that Johann Hari had seen about Vietnam.
Yeah, so he did a TED talk a couple of years ago, and the name of it was called "The Opposite of Addiction is Connection," I believe.
Yeah,
you know, the notion being, you know, we think the opposite of addiction is sobriety. No, it's not. The opposite of addiction is connection. If you don't have you know, bonds, connections, if you don't have someone to bond with, you'll bond with something. But he said there was an equivalent experiment of Rat Park going on in the human dimension when Rat Park was done in the 1970s, which was the Vietnam War. We had a whole bunch of people over there using heroin because they were caged up in a war, the loads of death. When they came back stateside, though, the majority of those soldiers just quit using drugs.
Right.
About 5% of them did go to rehab, but a very small percentage. A lot of, you know, some of them were on the street, but the majority of them, they just came back stateside, you know, got reintegrated back in their communities with their families and went back to reliving their lives.
Right. And I would imagine a lot of those that didn't make it back like that had suffered such incredible trauma over there in Vietnam in the first place that they were using the drugs to address that. So, yeah, there's just a lot of evidence that it is the quality of the life. It's not just a character flaw. It's not that these people are just bad or broken or throwaway people. These are people that have gone through something, and we are throwing them in a cage as a consequence for that initial trauma. Hey, we got to take one more break. We're talking to Brett Montague here. He's the CEO with End It for Good. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about your organization, how people can get in touch with you, and how they can hear more.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll be right back.
All right, we're here with Brett Montague from End It For Good, the CEO. Brett, we could talk about this stuff for hours and hours. I have. So how can people get hours and hours of material? Tell them where they can find End It For Good's material.
Well, yeah. So first of all, let me just say that End It For Good is Mississippi's only grassroots nonprofit that invites people to support approaches to drugs that prioritize life and the opportunity to thrive. But our website is enditforgood.com. We were started by Christina Dent in 2017. You can go to enditforgood.com and watch an 18-minute TED Talk that she did in 2019.
Great talk.
That tells our story.
Yeah.
We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok as well. We have a podcast, like you mentioned a minute
ago.
Yeah,
check out that podcast. Yeah. The great Mike Madison's on that thing, I understand, sometimes.
He is sometimes. I have heard that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, so definitely check them out. You've got an event coming up, too?
Yeah, we do. We have an event coming up in Jackson, Mississippi at St. James Church.
Oh, that's where I grew up.
Oh, yeah. Is it? Okay. Yep. It will be the evening of July 14th, and we're looking to have a great crowd with a wide variety of stakeholders, from soccer moms to law enforcement to elected officials, rehab officials.
Yeah.
The
war on drugs reaches into a lot of lives. Even if you don't have people with addiction, there's a lot of public policy made around the war on drugs that I think it affects us all. It really does. It's become a very big thing and I think a pretty big disaster. It's time to at least rethink it, and I think most people should be open to that.
1 in 3 families are directly impacted by addiction. And if I can just say, too, if anybody wants to reach out to me directly, talk to me, ask a question, challenge me on something, they can reach me at brett@enditforgood.com.
Okay. Great, Brett. Thanks so much for coming in. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
No
bye-bye.
Matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.